Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the movie geeks begin their celebration of the greatest films of the 70s with an in-depth exploration of Robert Altman's classic film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, with producer David Foster, actor Corey Fisher, author Robert Self, and critic Doug Pratt. Welcome, everyone, to this very special episode of Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to this very special show.
Yeah, we're excited about this. First of all, it's, no question, the 70s mean a lot to you and I.
Yes, they do.
And most movie fans out there with a sense of history.
That's a nice little dig there at the Jonas Brothers and Paul Blart.
Yes.
Ticket buying audience.
but we're very much excited to bring you this series of shows, and it's a great pleasure to start out this series with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, because this is a film in the Altman canon that, for a unique filmmaker, this might be one of his most unique and exceptional films. And it's just started to build up some momentum over the past few years as people have rediscovered this film. And so we're very excited to bring you the people we have on tonight speaking about the experiences that they've had in relationship to this film. First of all, I think it's a good idea for those of you who are not as familiar with McCabe and Mrs. Miller or perhaps are in the process of rediscovering it to give you a sense of what the film is and what it's about. It takes place in the Old West at the start of the 20th century. John McCabe enters a small town in the Pacific Northwest on horseback, selling a dream because John McCabe.
Don't insult the man.
Yeah, I know, because John McCabe is a dreamer. He sets out to establish a tavern and a brothel, and he summons every ounce of his endearing charm to see it to fruition. Mrs. Miller soon arrives, a weary, opium-addicted, but strong-minded professional madam who talks her way into helping McCabe run his business. She understands the sensitivities and sensibilities of the prostitutes, something that the charismatic but bumbling, befuddled McCabe does not. The business thrives, but the rumblings of affection between the two of them do not. The town's mining potential attracts the attention of a major corporation whose representatives offer to buy McCabe out. But McCabe is stubborn, naive, and foolish. He refuses their offer at his peril. A gunfight ensues in the eerie tranquility of a snowstorm. McCabe is shot and killed, left upright in a growing mound of silent falling snow, while Mrs. Miller lies in an opium den, eyes glazed and haunted. And on the surface, this could be the skeleton of your standard Western, but predictability was never director Robert Altman's strong suit.
Never.
Released in 1971, McCabe and Mrs. Miller fell in line with the cinematic climate of the time in the way that it challenged genre conventions at every turn. The hero was more anti-hero, a self-described man who had poetry in him, but his worst enemy was himself. The strongest character was Mrs. Miller, yet, as Roger Ebert eloquently observed, she had already lost her poetry.
Mm-hmm,
and the film contains all of the Altman signatures, overlapping dialogue, multiple characters, and a version of typical narrative form, fueled by a trio of haunting Leonard Cohen tunes and shot as though we're eavesdropping through an antique haze. McCabe and Mrs. Miller stands as one of the most hypnotic and overwhelmingly beautifully sad films ever made. Like McCabe, the film has poetry in it, and it's poetry continues to resonate with us today. This is just an exceptional film. And Jerry, not even from a an aesthetic standpoint, it doesn't look like any other film ever made.
It looks like no other film. The only film that it looks like before it is Shoot the Piano Player. And that's
right.
The only film I can really honestly think of to say it looks like. Now, afterwards, there are countless films that have been influenced by it. I could go on and on about that.
Yeah, and we do go on quite a bit throughout the next 2 hours about how Altman liked to deconstruct genre and play around with gender types. There's all kinds of brave directions that Altman took his work. But let's begin our exploration of this landmark film with its producer, David Foster. Mr. Foster began his producing career with one of the all-time great 1-2 punches, with McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway. Other landmark films in his resume include The Drowning Pool, John Carpenter's The Thing, Short Circuit, Running Scared, The River Wild, and The Mask of Zorro. Over the better part of an hour, we spoke with Mr. Foster about his beginnings in the industry and his collaborations with giants like Peckinpah and McQueen, and his many exciting future projects. And you can find the entire uncut interview in our archives. They will go live following this program right here. But for now, we discuss all things McCabe, beginning with his first encounter with the novel on which the film is based.
Yeah.
So you're looking for, I would imagine, a property, and you find this novel, McCabe?
No, I mean, everything's got its own story. You know, it was fascinating, because I went to Paris for a meeting. I had a partner there named Mitchell Brower. If you look at the credits on McCabe, you'll see both of our names.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitch was a guy who came from the New York theater and came out to Los Angeles thinking he wanted to be in the motion picture world as a producer. And a mutual friend introduced us. And he had, well, let me finish with him. So anyway, he stayed around for a while, and we got along very well, but he realized after we did two pictures together, McCabe and The Getaway, and then he realized he missed New York, and New York was really his calling, and the theater was really his calling.
Hmm.
And he wound up running the New York State Theater at Lincoln Center, which was really best for him. You know, I mean, I stayed here, obviously. But so anyway, that's what happened. Is I went to Paris to meet with a very famous French authoress, Simone de Beauvoir.
Mm-hmm.
Her name meaning to you guys?
I know the name.
Yeah. She was like the first feminist. She was the lover of Jean-Paul Sartre.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's where I know the name. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And she wrote a book called The Mandarins. And in that book, in the center of it, was a fictional love story. No, it was a real love story. She fictionalized the names. She had a big love affair with an American, underbelly novelist named Nelson Algren. Walk on the Wild Side, wrote a lot of tough American stories. And they had a big, big love affair. And Mitch and I thought that would make one hell of a movie.
The Man with the Golden Arm, right?
Yes, same guy.
Okay.
Same guy. And so Mitch and I thought, well, the Nelson Algren, Simone de Beauvoir story would make a hell of a movie, only she changed the names in The Mandarins. But it was the same story, the love story. And people had offered her tons of money for the rights to that story, and she was sort of a socialist communist and rejected everybody. I mean, Daryl Zanuck. I mean, literally, because, you know, he spent a lot of time in Paris with that. He had an affair with that French singer, dancer, I forget her name. But he was, you know, he had a big,
yeah.
he spent a lot of time in Paris. So he tried to get it. Everybody tried to get it. And here comes this 24-year-old, no, by then I'm like 28 now, I think, young guy, arranged a meeting with her agent in Paris, who was an American, a Caucasian woman named Ellen Wright, who was married to the black American author Richard Wright.
Mm-hmm.
You know who he is, of course.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And native son and all
yes.
that. And,
mm-hmm.
and they left the United States because in those days racial marriage was a no-no.
Well, Paris was the place to go at that time.
Yeah, very bohemian, very,
mm-hmm.
you know, very cool. So they went there, and she became Simone de Beauvoir's agent. So I met with her to try to get these rights, and then she, well, Simone's going to have to meet you. And so I go meet Simone de Beauvoir, which was like I'm trembling. Like, she's a big deal lady in her day.
Yeah.
And I remember ringing the doorbell, and she opened it. And she said, "Come in. What do you smoke? What do you smoke? Filtered, non-filtered. Scotch, bourbon. What do you drink?" You know, that was one of those. Anyway, so we got the rights to it, and as I'm leaving Paris, Ellen Wright gives me a book called McCabe, and she says, "Oh, this was written by a guy named Edward Norton who works for the New York Times Paris Bureau. Roman Polanski showed interest in it. John Huston showed interest in it, but somehow they went on to do other things. But you should read this. It's a hell of a movie." So I take the book and I read it on the flight home. I cannot put it down. I'm going over the pole, like from Paris to L.A.
Wow.
And I read this book, and by the time I got off the plane and got home, I called my attorney. I said, "Okay, two-picture deal. the Mandarins, she approved, and McCabe and Mrs. The book is called McCabe."
Mm-hmm.
And when we knew that Daryl Zanuck was interested in he tried to get the Mandarin story. We knew that. My attorney was a guy named Frank Wells, who became a legend in Hollywood.
Yes.
He was a guy that died in that helicopter crash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We lived across the street from each other for like 18 years. He was more than my attorney. He was a great, great friend.
Mm-hmm.
And we were neighbors all that time. And so we knew that, well, it should be a slam dunk at Fox if Daryl Zanuck loved it, you know. And so, I'm talking about the Mandarins. So we make that deal, and we throw in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. So it becomes a two-picture deal, right,
mm-hmm.
at Fox. No sooner do we make these deals, we go to work, than the shit hits the fan at Fox. Daryl Zanuck got thrown out. Dick Zanuck, I believe, was running the place for his father, and there was all kinds of, you know, Cleopatra, all kinds of scandals about money going, you know.
Yeah, Dick Zanuck would be, because he went on to do all the Planet of the Apes movies there, so.
Right.
Right.
And it became a nightmare, and, you know, so Frank Wells, by then, had left being a private attorney and went to work at Warner Brothers, where he headed up the legal department. And so I called Frank, and like in 48 hours, we had a deal at Warner Brothers.
Wow.
And so that's where McCabe was finally made, as I'm sure you know.
Well, I'm sure that, yeah, it was Warner Brothers. Tell me about the book and that flight, and when you read it, what struck you about it? What made you think this has to
Well, the characters were just great. I mean, both McCabe and Mrs. Miller, you know.
Yeah.
They were just great. And frankly, I'm kind of a nutcake for research and history in these kind of stories. And it's all, you know, it's a fictional story, but it's set in a completely factual setting. I mean, the Chinese did come and build the railroads
mm-hmm.
in America. And I don't know if you remember the beginning of the pictures, Chinatown, and he right. dies in China. She dies in Chinatown, smoking the opium pipe.
Right.
And I remember spending hour upon hour upon hour at USC, the Chinese Studies Department, researching the Chinese in the West. And that really turned me on. Plus, the characters were very, very rich. I mean, he was such a goofball. I mean, you know, he wanted to be such a big-time guy, and he was never going to be a big-time guy.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys remember the story. And I sort of felt really sorry for the guy, you know. Just
mm-hmm.
He was kind of a loser-type guy, and he had this big opportunity. He thought to himself, and then he goes down to that town at the bottom of the hill, the mountains, where he meets Mrs. Miller, and Mrs. Miller overhears him, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of a woman, an English woman in the West, being entrepreneurial herself,
mm-hmm.
and going to him and saying, Yeah, you, what do you mean you're going to run a whorehouse? You don't know about a whorehouse. You know when they have their period. You know when they do this. You know, and they keep firing off all this stuff about women.
Yeah.
That he's overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think it was the characters set in, and it was not a classic Western in terms of horses and shoot 'em up and stuff. And that's what interested me too. The West was the setting, but
mm-hmm.
it was not. That story could take place today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. I mean, I remember reading on the plane. I could not put the damn thing down. I mean, I read it. And, you know, it's from Paris to L.A. nonstop is like 12 hours.
Yeah.
Think about that. Oh my God.
Well, you know, you've mentioned a couple of very interesting things that lead to my next question, because you mentioned the strength being the characters,
right?
And it not being your typical Western. And if Robert Altman is known for anything, it's kind of for genre deconstruction and not necessarily being interested so much in the story as the
character.
People that pop. Yeah, yeah.
More like genre Armageddon, really.
And language,
yeah.
Dialogue, language.
Yeah.
Well, that was interesting, too, because nobody really knew Bob Altman in those days. He did a picture called, I think it was called Sunday in the Park.
Mm.
In Canada, and then not Sunday in the Park. What am I talking? Wasn't that a play, Sunday in the Park?
I think
with George. Yeah.
No, it was a picture he did in Canada with Sandy Dennis, I think. If you look up his bio, you'll. It was before, and then he did. Point is, he came to the States to do. Well, he is an American, but he came back down to Hollywood to do MASH.
So, hey, that Cold Day in the Park.
Cold Day
yeah.
in the Park. I know there's a park in there somewhere.
There's a park. Yeah.
Anyway, he did that in Vancouver. And with Sandy Dennis, I believe, and then he came down. Fox hired him to do MASH,
mm-hmm.
and when he finished the picture, finished shooting, and he was back in L.A. doing post production, mixing, and all that stuff. His then agent was a guy named George Lito, L-I-T-T-O,
mm-hmm.
George Lito, who was a friend of mine, and. We were talking, and he said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Well, I got this book that's set in the West, but it's not a Western. It's really offbeat as hell." And I was describing it, and he said, "Boy, that's something Bob Altman would want to do, I'm sure." And I said, "Who's Bob Altman?" I didn't know. And he said, "No one really knew Bob then."
Yeah.
And he said, "You come, you'll meet him." So I meet Bob Altman, and then they arrange for me to go to a screening, a rough cut screening of MASH.
Mm-hmm.
Which was actually was a screening for the composer, Johnny Mandel. It was a music screening. And they sneaked me into the studio, to the projection room at Fox, because no one was supposed to see the movie. It wasn't done yet. But Bob knew what he was doing. And so I sat there. And it blew my mind. And from that point on, we shook hands, and the agent said, "You guys, if you believe what you're saying, Foster, and Bob, if you believe you made a great movie, then just shut up, be patient for 2-3 months, and if it's what everybody thinks, people are going to come running at you, and you'll have your next picture, and David, you'll be able to say, 'Oh, yeah, I have Bob Altman.'" Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
exactly what happened. I mean, it was amazing. And I mean, I went to New York with Bob for a sneak of... MASH, which I had nothing to do with. I just went because by then we'd become really good friends. And it was astonishing. Got off the plane. It was the opening. What am I saying? It was the New York opening. It had already been reviewed. And walking down the corridor at JFK, past a magazine stand, and we stop. We get New Yorker, New York Magazine, Time, some of them,
mm-hmm.
to look for the reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And like Pauline Kael was this immense love letter, you know, and it was really, really exciting. And that sort of made him, you know, and I had him. I had him for his next picture, although he did sneak in Brewster McLeod before us because
mm-hmm.
he had already been working on that.
He had that skill back then to just crank him out.
Yeah, and he had the style of you know, the
mm-hmm.
language and the overlapping dialogue. There was such a distinctive style that he had.
It was already there, yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't miss it. In fact, we remained friends till the very end. I must tell you a sad but funny story. Maybe about 7-8 months before he passed, whatever it was, he was given an honorary Oscar
mm-hmm.
at the Academy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was.
Yeah. It was just before that anyway. We were having lunch in L.A. because he lived in New York. But he kept a place in L.A., but basically spent most of his time in New York and in Europe. And he confided to me, don't you dare tell anybody, but I had a heart transplant.
Wow.
I said, you got to be kidding. He said, don't tell anybody, Jesus Christ, but I got to tell you. You know, well, I ain't going to say a word to anybody. Son of a bitch, he gets the Oscar, and he stands in front of 20 billion people and says, I'm younger than all of you. I had a heart transplant.
That's true.
Yeah.
So tell me about, you know, the director and the man. Obviously, as you just said, you knew him for many years.
Yeah,
what made him special?
I'm not the world's greatest expert, but I think I know him pretty well. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure his wife knew him a hell of a lot better. But what I knew was a guy that was very, very inventive, mm-hmm. and had a great skill in letting you think that it was your idea, that you came up with something, that he positioned you in such a way that it was really his idea. And it was always so that it was amazing. When I figured it out, and we laughed about it, I said, you son of a bitch. I said, that was your idea all along, wasn't it? And he said, yeah, don't tell Warren, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, you don't want to let that out, yeah.
Oh, God. And so he was very, very inventive, and he had, like, he was a gambler in life and in movies. I mean, I remember once on McCabe, during the pro football season, it was about to start, and he did, Bob did a football pool. Everybody put in $5 or $10, I forget the amount. And you picked a bunch of teams. You know how that works.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a football pool is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right. So he instigated all that. He was losing money like crazy, and then he'd win some, but then he'd bet with bookies on the side, you know. And then one day, the pool was won by Julie Christie. And no one could say, what the hell? I mean, she's an English lady. She doesn't know diddly squat about professional football in the NFL. So I went up to her and I said, Julie, how did you pick those? And she said, I just picked cities I'd like in the United States.
I wouldn't put anything past her. She was in Darling, you know. I wouldn't put
anything
past her.
She's great.
Yeah.
She's great.
But,
California Split was autobiographical then.
Oh, yeah, he was. That would be him, believe me, you know.
Yeah.
But he loved to gamble, and he loved he loved to be the grand poobah, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had when I first met him, do you know LA at all, you guys?
Yeah. I lived there for a year.
He owned a little building, small building on Westwood Boulevard, south
mm-hmm.
of Wilshire.
Oh yeah, okay.
And we'd all meet there at all times, and he had a barber chair, which was his chair. and he would sit in his barber chair, and he would rotate it around. You know how barber chairs move?
Yeah.
And basically everybody would sit at his feet, and he would make great pronouncements, you know. And once you were part of his family, you invited to everything. I mean, there was not a movie he made after McCabe that he would not call me and say, I want you to come see this, tell me what you think, you know. And he'd always have these little screenings in this little building that he owned. He had a projection room there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing a picture he did with Paul Newman.
Was it
Buffalo
Quint?
Bill?
Quint.
Which one?
Buffalo Bill?
Or Buffalo
yes,
Bill.
Buffalo Bill.
Oh, Buffalo Bill,
yeah.
Okay.
And then the Three Sisters, I think, either the Sisters or whatever.
Three Women?
Mm-hmm. God, I'm so bad with titles.
Don't worry about it.
I can't remember what I had for breakfast, let alone.
don't worry about it.
No, but anyway, so once you were in his family, it was you could never be out unless you really were a sleaze bag and you double crossed somebody or whatever. But
yeah.
You know, I can remember, like, because New York was really his home, and even though he kept the place here, whenever we'd go to New York, I'd call Bob like a week in advance. It was whether it was my wife and me or if I just had to go on business, whatever. And he'd say, okay, meet you at Elaine's on Tuesday night at 9 o'clock. Yeah. You know, it was that famous literary restaurant, Elaine's, you know. And he introduced me to Elaine's. And whenever I go to New York, I become a regular. Sometimes I even call from L.A. and say, Elaine, I'm coming. You know, and or Bob would make these reservations. And he had this there was a group of people in New York that loved him and that he loved. Paddy Chayefsky was one of them, the writer.
Wow.
I don't know. There was just the guy who wrote Peter Stone. Peter
mm-hmm.
Stone. I think he wrote Charade, didn't he? I think so. Anyway, he had this group of friends, and they would always have dinner together. I don't know how he'd do it. I mean, you know, I can't wait to have a night at home and just go home and pass out.
What an amazing time that had to be.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was. And he did things like he flashed the film. You know what that is? The studio had a heart attack. What they would do, and when they found out, they nearly freaked out. He would shoot the film, and we used a lab in Vancouver, a small lab that did a lot of film work in Vancouver. And they would let a pin light of light saturate the film. You could expose it and blow the whole day shooting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Too much light, you know? But it was
right.
Infinitesimal. And it would just fog the film very slightly.
Yeah.
So it gave it the look of age. That's why it looks the way it looks.
Oh.
It made it look antique-ish almost.
Mm-hmm.
It gave it a sense of age.
Yeah.
And that was a Bob Altman thing. And the cinematographer was Wilmer Siegmund, who became came out one of the great cinematographers.
Legends, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it was his second job. He did another picture beforehand. And in fact, only last year, Wilmer was honored at the Ojai Film Festival. They just don't do actors or directors or producers. They do all kinds of people. And he was like,
mm-hmm.
for his body of work. And they asked Julie and me to present the film and to present Wilmer, which we gladly did. And the picture they showed of his was McCabe.
Yeah, it is still one of the monuments of cinematography. It's still a textbook
without a doubt.
Film.
Yeah.
Now,
odd thing is that Warren and he and Bob, you know, that they just never connected somehow. After the picture, after the deal was done, I don't know, something happened that no one's ever been party to. I think Warren, feels that he wrote the script, produced it, directed it. And that sounds kind
of
shitty.
That's not unheard of. I mean, given Warren's personality, I mean,
it was a sad thing because... Because it was probably one of the best performances he's ever given.
I think so, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really sad that they never were able to pack. I must tell you a very funny story about that. God, I'm just reminiscing like crazy.
No, we're loving
this. This is why we want you on. We want these stories.
They had a really unfortunate relationship, let's say that, and leave it at that. And the day after we wrapped, Warren went off to Berlin to do a picture for Richard Brooks called Dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't think many people ever heard of it, actually. And
we have.
Yeah, unfortunately, it didn't fare very well. Didn't fare very well, you know. And so Bob got really angry because when that book, Drugs, Something and Something, you know, that famous book about the 70s.
Easy Rider,
Raging Bold.
Yeah.
Oh, I can see where he would hate that. Okay.
Yeah, and Warren was quoted saying he wrote a lot of it and he directed some of his. And Bob was ready to sue him.
Mm-hmm.
He said he produced some of it, and you know, and all I can remember is I developed a script with Bob. I made the deal at Warner Brothers with Frank Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Bob chose to do the picture in Vancouver because he did A Cold Day in the Park in Vancouver, so he knew the place. So for him to say that was just offensive as hell. It was my first film, so it was a lesson for me, you know. So anyway, so they didn't talk for a long time because Bob was ready to sue him when that book came out because of the quotes that he gave.
Mm-hmm.
So many, many, many years later, well, the book was out maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years, something like that. I am having lunch with a director friend of mine named John Amiel. And we're having lunch at a restaurant in West L.A. called the L.A. Farm,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a movie hangout. And so I meet John Amiel there. And as I walk in at another table, about 4 tables away, I see Bob Altman, who is mixing that Richard Gere Doctor's picture.
Dr. T, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This restaurant, L.A. Palm, is part of a group of a studio called Lantana, if that means anyone. Anyway, this restaurant is there. And, you know, I mean, I've done 3 movies out of Lantana. It's a great place. And Bob and Lucas Sound is there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do your mixing in L.A. without going up north, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's where Bob did a lot of his mixing. And I walk in, and there's John. I say, I'll be right over. And I see Bob. Bob says, come on over, man. Come on over. So I have John and Neil come over. And he was thrilled to meet Bob Altman, actually. And we had a nice visit. And then John went back to the table, waited for me. And then Warren Beatty walked in.
Mm.
And I'm standing up saying goodbye to Bob, you know, and there's Warren. He walks over, and the three of us hugged. And
wow.
It was standing up, and it was like the first time, I cannot tell you. I mean, I don't know the last time. Probably the last time you saw him was at the end of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like nothing had ever happened. I want to believe that it was like his way of making up. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was unfortunate because, you know, Julie got nominated for the best actress that year for McCabe, and Warren didn't, which I thought was a cheat. He got robbed. And
it really was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that pissed him off. I don't know. It just that was the only time I ever saw them really together after that, you know.
Well, that's great that they had a moment where it wasn't.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm sure
yeah,
he
well,
passed on. I'm sure Warren had lots of regrets.
Yeah, but it's clear when you see the movie, this is an Altman film. There's no doubt about it.
God, yes. God.
And I'm wondering when you watched the finished product. You've obviously been through it from its inception.
Right.
Does it surprise you?
Always.
Yeah.
I mean, as talented as he is, I always find different things I didn't realize before in it. And like watching the carpenters build a town,
mm-hmm.
The last time I looked at it, oh, my God, I remember that now. We actually hired real carpenters that lived and worked. They were professional carpenters. And we had them all go into wardrobe and said, you're living in 1900, pick out what you would wear. And they literally built the town while we were shooting scenes in the foreground.
Wow.
I mean, you know, you would ordinarily hire guys to do that, you know?
Right.
Carpenters, but we wanted to make sure they were like in the movie. It looked like the town was growing, you know?
There's so that sense, yeah.
Yeah, so they actually went, each one of those guys was not an actor. A couple of them were actors, but most of them were real carpenters. And they went in and said, I would wear that probably, and I would wear that, and I would, you know, and then they'd pick out what they would wear. They wear it every day to work.
Mm.
But I mean, things like that. It was astonishing. And then I must say that my mind is going crazy right now. We had a big, big screening in New York. Did you ever hear about the Criterion screening?
The Criterion screening.
The Lowe's Criterion was a big theater on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and it was a big press screening, and. All the critics in New York and friends, it was like one of those big movie theaters of
mm-hmm.
the 1940s, like 1,000 people or whatever, you know. And the sound system went out.
Oh.
And the sound as it was tricky because of the overlapping,
mm-hmm.
sure.
You know. And it just was all screwed up. And Bob ran up to the booth, and everybody was panicking and stuff, and finally it simmered down. But it haunted Bob. And that night we had agreed that we were going to meet at the Russian Tea Room, which is a popular restaurant in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all met there, Warren, Julie, Bob and his wife, me and my wife, and whoever else, I can't remember, the editor, Louis Lombardo.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of it, Bob got up and ran out in the street. He was going to go home. He wanted to see his mama. He was going to go back to Kansas City to see his mom. It was like, I got to go see mommy, you know. He was so shook up by it all, you know. It was an amazing thing. Warren and I had to get him in the middle of 57th Street and drag him back into the restaurant.
Wow. You know, there's something about this film, and I told you when we spoke last week that I discovered it just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impossible for me to describe its effect on me and how it achieves that effect. There's something very magical about it, but mm-hmm. something heartbreakingly sad as well.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, but so kind of sad.
It's very sad. Very sad.
Yeah. Maybe there's nothing to this, but...
Because the love story is unfinished, you know. It's a, that's the saddest part of it all. He dies in the snow, you know, getting shot in the head, and she's in the Chinese whorehouse or whatever it was, smoking opium, you know. What's interesting, I have a young grandson who goes to Brown University, and he's a complete movie nut. I mean, one day I'll be working for him. I mean, he's really smart. And,
right.
And he had heard about McCabe, but never really saw it. And then there was, I think there was a screen, there's a place out here called the Aero Theater, which runs...
Oh, that's great.
Oh, that's a great place.
Yeah,
yeah.
Old movies and stuff, mm-hmm. and they had one of those things. And anyway, and he's like 20 years old, 19 years old. And he's so, Drew is so touched by this, you know, and he's, the picture's like 30 some odd years old, you know,
yeah.
And it's compelling to people when they see it, and there's something about it that haunts you. It really is haunting, you know. It's like one of my proudest moments, Frank, I might have told it to you the other day when we spoke, Jamie, the Museum of Modern Art Film Archives called me, oh God, a bunch of years ago, whenever it was, too many years ago, asking if they wanted to print for their archives, which is kind of a big honor, I think, you know.
That's enormous.
So, yeah, so I got Warner Brothers to send them a print, right? So a bunch of years later, I'm in New York with my oldest boy, who then is maybe 14. He's now a very successful producer. His name is Gary Foster. His first film was Sleepless in Seattle. Oh, good
wow.
God.
Well,
wow.
I mean,
he's
following
in his father's footsteps.
Yeah, but
we
your first film was McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
we have a dynasty. My middle son is the president of IMAX, so stop with that. So
yeah.
Anyway, so Gary is 14 years old, and I take him to New York the first time. I'm on a business trip. We're screening The Getaway for Pauline Kael and for that other lady at New Yorker. What the hell is that other woman critic?
Oh, God,
Judith
I know who you're talking about.
Judith Crist.
Oh,
Judith Crist.
Right.
Judith Crist. And all these people, you know. And now I'm a producer, and my ex-partners in the publicity business, one of them is Lois Smith. You may know that name. I don't know. She's my old company, when I left, they folded into a place called PMK.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take Gary to the, you know, Time to Kill. I didn't think about it initially. And we go into the Museum of Modern Art, you know, and we're wandering around. And then I realize, holy Christ, my movie is somewhere in the basement here, somewhere, you know. I wonder if it's in the catalog. You know, you go to a library, you open the file of the catalog thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I walked over there with Gary and said, let me see something, Gary. And there it is, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and it says the cast is produced by, directed by. And I call him over and said, look at this, Gary. This is one of the big thrills of my life, because I'm from New York originally. For my name and my film to be at the Museum of Modern Art, and he looks and he says, there's David Foster, you know, and it says McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and it has Bob's name, of course, and Warren and everybody else, you know. It was really kind of a small, thrilling moment.
The, oh, it had to have been,
a,
yeah.
A recognition of some sort, you know.
Mm.
Anyway, now I'm doing that with my grandsons. Both, two of them are crazy movie buffs. Lucas and Drew are just out of their minds about movies. And they go to all the old movies, which
well,
is
that,
that's great.
Good,
that
but
is
I
great.
Need to point out something. You say they're both movie buffs. Those are the people who should be making movies.
Let me ask you one more question about McCabe.
Sure,
because
please.
In over the years, you know, I've read where you have said that, and you've told me that this is your favorite film from your resume.
Yeah. Sure.
It wasn't really, outside of Kael and a few other critics, it didn't receive the recognition it so deserved upon its release, did it? It's kind of grown and acclaimed as the years have gone by.
No, it didn't. Again, it was the serious film critics loved it. Truthfully, I don't think it ever made the cost of prints and ads. The picture cost, I think, in those days, God, don't hold me to this, but I think it cost about $7.5 million. That's what one bum actor gets today. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I think it cost about $7.5 million, and but a ticket then was about $1.25, I believe, something like that. And but it never made the cost of prints and ads, and maybe through starting with videotapes, videocassettes, and now with DVDs, and somewhere in between there was a short-lived laser discs. But maybe with the DVDs it finally might have paid for itself. Now, it's just a film that is extraordinary, I think. It's just so unique. And, I'm happy with most of the films I've produced. I mean, some of them don't come out as good as you hope they would. I mean, the scripts sometimes are better than the ultimate film.
Right.
Sometimes the director doesn't see what the writer and the producer saw. Sometimes the actor, it goes astray, as much as, and then I'm sort of a guy who's involved without trying. I think my reputation is I know what it is in town. My reputation in Hollywood is that I get along with people because I don't see the advantage of being a prick.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what
yeah.
you gain by doing that. I just don't see that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that and stories. I develop stories a lot, or I find stories that I like. The first three films I ever made were all paperback books that no one had ever heard of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the point is that there are films that I'm so disappointed in that you give, like, your blood to it and your life to it, and it comes out and you say, oh, my God, where the hell did this come from, Where did we go so wrong here? And then there are others, and the number one will always be my first child, I guess, your firstborn. It's a great movie.
All right, that is producer David Foster speaking about his first producing credit, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Great guy. I mean,
oh, wonderful guy. Just wonderful.
So generous with his time for us and to speak about this film. And there's lots more that we talked about. That's only a little more than half the interview we conducted.
That's right.
We just kept all the Altman McCabe references. But the uncut interview with David Foster can be found in our archives. You can find them after the live airing of this show right here. All right, we got a packed show tonight, so let's get to our next guest, Jerry.
Let's do it. I think William Friedkin was going to call in and do this for me, but then he backed out at the last minute. But here we go. Our next guest began his feature film career under the guidance of Robert Altman in three consecutive films, MASH, Brewster McCloud, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Actor Corey Fisher has made an incredible mark on film, television, and the stage for over 40 years. In addition to his collaborations with Altman, we speak to Mr. Fisher extensively about his role as the co-founder of the Traveling Jewish Theater. You can hear our entire uncut interview in the archives and read more about Mr. Fisher on his website at www.coreyfisher.com. We begin tonight's conversation with an exploration of Altman's unique approach as a director of actors.
For McCabe, at the time it had a very odd title. It was called The Presbyterian Church Wager. Because the town, which I think is still the case in the film, the name of the town is Presbyterian Church. The settlement that they're making there.
Yeah.
And the script was based on a book called McCabe, a Western, I guess, a Western novel, The thing about Bob Altman, though, was whatever you saw in the script, you kind of got to understand after a while, after working with him for a while, that anything you saw in a script was guaranteed not to wind up in the film, or probably it probably wouldn't even get shot, because especially a script that existed before production had even started, that was simply a rough guide for casting more than anything, because the actual script was sort of hammered out day by day mainly between Robert and Warren Beatty.
Mm.
Warren Beatty had a huge role in shaping that film. He was, of course, a co-producer, and he was very passionately involved, and of course Julie Christie and he were a couple at the time. And so he was much more than simply an actor coming in to do a job. He was he and Bob really collaborated, I think.
Yeah, and one of his best performances, I think.
Yeah,
McCabe. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Tell me, you mentioned improvisation and his search for actors that were capable of that. That was an important quality that he looked for in his actors generally, or was it just for that one project in MASH?
No, it was always, I mean, including McCabe and I think pretty much all his films ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And what, now, you know, improvisation is very misunderstood a lot. I mean, it's really a spectrum, you know. I think every performance, whether it's on film or in the theater, on television, every performance has some degree of improvisation in it. And every performance has some degree of preparation in it. So it's always a question of how much improv in relation to how much preparation.
Yeah.
Now, in film, again, there's a huge range. What Bob liked to do was, because he was so interested in creating a world and then going in and filming it almost the way a documentary filmmaker would, he liked to have a whole crew, a stable of actors, his posse kind of, who would inhabit this world and know how to contribute to the creation of this world without having to be told or what to do or have things written for them. So he'd be setting up the scene, say, in MASH, where there's an actual written scene between, you know, Hawkeye and Trapper going on. But he then tells three or four of us who are playing other doctors in the tent, say, hanging out, he says, go, I want you guys to be talking about, you know, how drunk you got the night before and what happened. And so we would go off and kick it around and sort of come up with a loose scenario for some dialogue. And he'd listen to it and say, great. And then while the main scene was going on, he'd have us doing our dialogue in the background.
Hmm.
And a lot of it would overlap. And he didn't always shoot in the traditional way of doing a master shot and then close-ups. He would often try to do things in one take with the camera moving. He kind of pioneered what they now call the walk and talk kind of shot they used to do a lot on West Wing.
Right.
Where the camera keeps moving and actors move in and out of the shot as mm-hmm. the scene progresses, which is very hard to do. It really requires ensemble work, teamwork between the crew and the actors. It's almost like filming a live event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he liked to do it. So he liked to create many layers of activity. In fact, you know, again, Leon Erickson, the art director, brought in entire buildings from the prairies, from the plains in Canada, old mm-hmm. farm buildings that they found in God knows where, Calgary area, and actually, you know, I don't know, disassembled them enough to be able to move them and then rebuilt them on what was essentially some empty ground that was waiting to be developed in North Vancouver that he was able to get for the shoot. And of course, it happened to be a winter with those incredible heavy snows. All that was real. And but for months before the actors arrived, they were building this town. And then a lot of the carpenters they hired, you know, in those days, there were a lot of hippie carpenters hanging around Vancouver and the Northwest. And they were delighted to just be able to stay there on this in this town they'd built and actually live there for a while.
Wow.
And that's what they did. So there were no false fronts. Every building was a practical building with people living in it. And cooking and, you know, carrying on their life. It was sort of like, it was kind of like a be-in that they used to have in the 60s, you know, that kind of event or a Renaissance fair. It was that sense of this community that was created that was almost independent of the fact that there was a film being made.
I'm wondering, did you get that sense when you were working on it that this was a completely new direction to take this genre?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we knew it was a new direction, for sure. Now, whether or not at the time, I don't know. I couldn't say that I was aware that he was deconstructing the Western, because that requires a kind of almost hindsight and a perspective and a knowledge that I was a young dude back then. I was in my early 20s, and I don't know that I knew that much about film history to really get all that. Certainly not, you know, back when we did MASH, we didn't know what we were doing, you know, in a sense. Which was great, because they left us alone. They left Bob alone, you know. Nobody, he was like the 23rd director they had offered that script to for MASH.
Was everyone afraid? Was everyone afraid of it because of
nobody,
the war?
Or they didn't, I don't know. Maybe, or they just didn't get it. And again, and it always, to me, it was ironic that it was Ring Lardner Jr. who wound up getting an Oscar for that, right? For the screenplay. Because casting no aspersions on him as a writer, the film that was shot was not the script he wrote. You know, there was so many rewrites on the set. Not that people were improvising on camera, but often the scene would be rewritten, reworked during rehearsals. Now, minutes before it would get shot, which is the way, you know, some directors work entirely by the script. You know, they don't want you to change a word. Some TV shows, you absolutely cannot change a word as it comes down. I 2 years ago, I did one of the last episodes of Frasier. Mm-hmm. And on a show like Frasier, you know, it's off with your head if you dare mess with a syllable. Because those writers, you know, they have spent hours crafting this, and they know the characters and the setup and the style. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a tight ship. But with the kind of filmmaking that Bob did, it was all being created in the moment. And there was no, you know, if you really, I mean, now I would say he was really a postmodernist, in the sense of he didn't work vertically. There wasn't this vertical hierarchy of, you know, the writer sits there and crafts this artifact that is the script that is then handed down. Mm-hmm. The next stop to the director, who then hands it down to the crew and the cast who make it happen, and everything is set according to the upper level, what's handed down to you. It's more horizontal. It's like everyone is contributing at different times, maybe, but everything, you know, in that kind of postmodern view, working on the horizontal, everything becomes worthy of exploration. You don't take anything for granted. You don't pretend to know what is the most important element in a scene.
Yeah.
And that's why he would go for this density. And maybe then in the editing room, this little throwaway that one of us more background characters was doing might actually get used. Sometimes something would emerge from one of these improvisations that would really, inspire Bob maybe to build something that he hadn't thought of.
You know, but I get that sense watching his movies that process would kind of mutate and it would be an ongoing sense of discovery because with a movie like McCabe, it feels like it's a living thing. And
yeah.
I'm wondering, as a director, you've obviously worked with so many directors since Altman. Looking back at him, what made him unique? How did he direct you? What was his technique?
Well, what was unique is he invited you into the process. Again, it's that horizontal thing I'm talking about. He didn't look at actors as kind of, some directors, you know, don't really like actors so much.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a necessary evil. Some love actors, but are much more interested in the performance. You know, the image they're projecting. Bob saw the actor as a creative partner, as someone who knew as much or more about the character than anyone,
yeah,
the writer or the director. And so he wanted to know what you thought and felt, and if what was written didn't feel right to you, he'd want to know why or what else? What's the alternative? So there was that sense of inclusion that nobody is just a cog in the wheel.
Yeah.
Or a cog in the machine. What else? Well, so many directors don't pay any attention to the actors, really, unless they're really doing something awful,
mm-hmm.
but they're really, all their energy and attention is going into the look, continuity, shaping the film, and just assuming the actor is going to do what's required, that they're going to be professional enough to understand what's needed scene by scene, and, you know, they'll give directions like, no, you've got to stand a few inches off this way. You're in the way of somebody's light. Or, I want more energy here. Or, you know, kind of result-oriented direction rather than process-type work. So
he loved the characters above all else. He said he really cared more about the characters than the story. He said, I don't care much about story. And so I would think that his primary focus would be the actors. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, you know, I think in a way that's a kind of a false dichotomy because the story emerges from character. And character is created by events. A character to me, and I think to Bob, was never a fixed thing, an unchanging entity. Where one person to our lover, we're a totally different person with our father. We're yet another person when we're, you know, a patient in a dentist chair. You know, we change so much depending on who we're relating to and what situation we're in. And that was another reason why the whole milieu, the environment, the ambiance was important, because character doesn't exist in isolation. Character is part of a larger context.
I'm wondering about your experience of seeing the movie. When you actually saw the finished product, it's such a magical film. Did it surprise you, its power, having been involved in it?
Well, frankly, it took me a long time to really get to the point where I could really see it and experience it the way, or even close to the way, someone who hadn't been involved would.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a large chunk of my life, you know, living in this house in North Vancouver, very close to the set. For me, there was an element of disappointment in that experience, because in the script that Bob gave me in Houston, the character he wanted me to do, Reverend Elliot, this insane minister,
mm-hmm.
was really a very central role. And there was a lot of material. I mean, he never talked much. In fact, he hardly spoke, which was part of the strength of the character. But there were a number of encounters between McCabe and this guy where McCabe would be trying to rattle him and get a rise out of him, and the guy would just stonewall him, you know, kind of maintain his strange, withdrawn madness.
Yeah.
And most of those scenes never got shot. That, you know, that's what I was alluding to when I said if you know, I learned that if you saw something too early in the process written down, there was a good chance it would never get used. And that's what happened in a way that, for me personally, was disappointing. And probably it was a very good move for the film. That as it emerged, was part really of a whole different conception. So the experience was strange, being up there for 13 weeks. And probably out of 13 weeks, there were maybe 5 days where I was really working a lot.
Yeah.
There would be day after day after day when I would never be on camera, never work, you know, which was true for a lot of us. And we'd be hanging out in the trailers. The fun part was a lot of us made music. There were a lot of guitar players and songwriters. I still know a guitar instrumental that we composed, a bunch of us composed together during those long days of waiting in the trailers. And then, of course, there would be some days where, you know, those handful of days where suddenly, you know, it was very exciting and compelling and being right in the middle of it. But it didn't turn out to be, for me as an actor, the kind of experience I imagined it was going to be in a lot of ways. So there was an element of disappointment there, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
Years later, of course, as I saw the film again and again with some distance, I became, you know, much more open to it and could really appreciate it for itself, not as part of my life.
Right.
Or some, you know, those associations sort of cooled off after a while.
Yeah, I understand that, but it seems like the movie lovers at large, the film community, film fan community, it wasn't so much appreciated upon its release, but as the years have gone by, it's kind of gained in its stature.
Yeah.
And people love it.
Yeah.
Have you found that when people approach you and
yes.
you discover? Yeah.
Well, I never run into anyone who didn't like it, who doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Whenever people, you know, whenever I meet someone new and we wind up talking about our lives and what have you done, what did you do, and whenever I mention that I was in that, they say, my God, really? Who are you? Oh, that's one of my favorite films. Where were you? Who were you? And they when I tell them, and of course the irony is the thing everybody remembers is the scene where the preacher plants the cross on top of the church, right?
Yeah.
Against the sun, setting sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible shot. So he climbs up the spire with this huge cross. And that wasn't me. That was the stunt guy. And I felt bad because Bob really wanted me to do it. And he tried so hard to convince me it was safe. But I have had a lifelong fear of heights.
Oh, yeah. I don't blame you.
Yeah, I
appreciate it so much, Corey. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Jenny.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that is actor Corey Fisher speaking about his collaborations with Altman. He did three early films with Altman, including MASH, Brewster McCloud, and, of course, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. That uncut interview is now available in our archives, or will be after this live show wraps. All right, this is a packed show. We're running a little bit behind. We're going to get to our third interview here, which is a great conversation, Jerry.
I love this guy. He was great. Robert T. Self is Professor Emeritus at Department of English at Northern Illinois University and the author of Robert Altman's Subliminal Reality and Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Reframing the American West. You can purchase Examination of McCabe by clicking on the icon on our homepage. We begin our conversation with an exploration of Robert Altman's deconstruction of genre.
There's two or three things that always come up when you're examining Altman's work, and one of the major elements of it is his deconstruction of genre.
Absolutely.
And the Western being, you know, the most American of genres.
Yes.
What did he find faults about the Westerns that had come before, and what was he trying to do in terms of genre with this one?
Well, I think you're right in general about that perspective in his work. It was almost like throughout his whole career, it's almost like he went from genre to genre saying, okay, I'm going to take this one apart now.
Sure.
I'm going to take
this one
apart now. And even when he did late in toward the end of his career, when he did The Gingerbread Man, he said, well, I've never done a thriller.
The film noir kind of thriller.
Yeah,
you know.
Does that very differently.
Yeah, and I think that he was almost like a one-man research and development project for revising Hollywood genres there in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Western is especially interesting. You know, he had spent a lot of time working in television before. Here in his late 40s, he moves to Hollywood and starts his Hollywood career. And one of the programs that he directed a lot, well, one was combat, so he had a lot of war movie genres under his belt, and he also did Bonanza.
Hmm.
And if you go back and look at some of those episodes of Bonanza, they're awful. I mean, they're impossible to watch because they're just the old-fashioned storytelling, you know, a soap opera practically with good guys and bad guys set in the West, and
yeah.
With a very specific narrative problem and tensions between the good guys and the bad guys and the girlfriends and the boyfriends, all of which gets worked out by a little bit of gunplay by the end of the story. And Altman hated all that. He didn't like that way of telling stories. He didn't like the simplicity of those kinds of stories. One of the producers back then said that Altman always wanted to edit his story sideways. Indeed, he got in trouble. He was routinely getting into trouble because he didn't tell the stories in the clear-cut beginning, middle, and end fashions that both television and Hollywood in those days wanted. I mean, he made a movie called Countdown in 1968, which is a journey to the moon that got him into all kinds of trouble in Hollywood because, you know, he had people talking at the same time. What's that all about? and so when he came to a movie like McCabe, I think partly his concern is Well, he says very explicitly, I don't like Westerns. I'm not telling this story because I like Westerns. I'm telling this story because it gives me an opportunity to look at things that are a part of that the Western genre in a different way. I think his he took a kind of not a bad Western a novel called McCabe by a guy named Ed Naughton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got all the regular all the syntax and all the iconography of
yeah.
a traditional Western. Yeah. And Allman said, you know, that book, and not just that book, but the genre itself, you know, everybody knows the story, so I don't have to tell the story. I can use the narrative as a line just to hang my essays on, or
mm-hmm.
I can, the audience has a sense of the general flow of what a Western is about, and what I can do then is look in the nooks and crannies, which are the most interesting things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you look at a movie like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, some of the most interesting and I think for a lot of folks puzzling things are just throwaway things.
Mm-hmm.
Things that just are, you know, why are we looking at this here now? Why do we get this zoom in on this guy playing a violin in the back of the space of the action? What are these little throwaway things? And I think that a part of his deconstruction, if you will, of the genres is that he could take for granted the story. He says, he always claimed he was not a very good storyteller. And that would let him do something that he was more interested in, which was look at the way in which people, not just spontaneously, but by luck and by happenstance, make their way through life in a life which doesn't have clear-cut beginnings and middles and ends, and life which
yeah.
doesn't have heroes all the times, and life which doesn't end with a happy ending, but frequently is most of his movies at the end in the 1970s did with somebody dying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think his two Westerns, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I call a poem, and his other Western, Buffalo Bill and the Indians, I think really is an essay. It's an essay in the kind of Godardian sense of using a movie to interrogate life and the way
yeah.
we think about life and the way we think about representation, because, you know, that whole movie is about how our concept of ourself is, and our concept of the West and our concept of the myth of the West is constructed by the show business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, William F. Cody never knew who he was because he was always either him or Buffalo Bill. Which one was he? And that split between those two names was a lovely launching point, I think, for Altman's investigation of this the way in which the Western works in our culture. So he's got different energies going on here, I think, in these two stories. One is, I think he takes the Western more seriously than he claims in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he really takes it apart in Buffalo Bill.
Well, and it's interesting along that line of thinking with his approach, in that he said, I don't equate my filmmaking with what a writer does or an author. I look at it as a kind of an impressionistic painting, and he's just trying to get kind of to establish some kind of impression of that time and that place, and that's another thing that sets Altman apart.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been noted in several high profile reviews of the film. More
mm-hmm.
than most other movies, you feel that sense of place there, like it
yeah.
has existed before they turned the camera on.
Yeah.
And individual scenes too, the overlapping dialogue. You
yeah.
come in on the middle of conversations in the background. These people existed in that bar before Warren Beatty walked in.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
important. thing you can say about, I think, his films, because there are a lot of films, especially today, where it does feel like it doesn't start until, you know, like you said, the camera's turned on.
The movie starts, yeah.
Yeah. And now, it's like, with Altman's films, like we're like interloping almost, or like eavesdropping, a wallflower almost.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's there's a complexity in that in his work. On one hand, there's a sort of drive toward realism, you know, as you say, well, it was already there. He's just discovered it. And certainly that's the effect of things like the overlapping dialogue and so forth. But at the same time, to create that space, it's painterliness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He works very hard. And some of it, I don't even know how hard it was. I mean, his tendency to move the camera is just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So that the space is never simply the space that's in front of the camera, but the camera is always sort of probing it and cutting into it or zooming into it. And so it's both there and it's created. What I mean? I mean, it's both realist. I think this is one of the characteristics of the art cinema anyway. There's a enhanced realism on one hand, but there's also an enhanced kind of expressionism on the other. I mean, you look at McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a glorious film visually.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is created by the experiments that he and Zygmunt were doing with the flashing of the film stock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a
risky endeavor in itself,
yeah.
What they did.
It's dangerous, too, because, of course, Hollywood didn't, the folks down in who were paying the bills weren't really sure they liked what they were seeing. But I think that, you know, even when you look at a film at the end of the film, when he stops flashing it in that whole gunfight scene in the snow,
mm-hmm.
There are flecks of gold and red in that image, that the snow at the end that's electronically enhanced. I mean, they did that in post production, and so you go, even when he's not playing with the camera or playing with the film stock, he's doing something else with it, so that the reality is both there and it's both captured and it's created at the same time.
Yeah. With that approach in mind, how important was a sense of historical accuracy?
That's a good question, too, especially since the Western is such a historical genre.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The historicity of the Western, it seems to me, is always has been, at least for me, a part of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Where am I in this Western? Okay, what time are we in here? It's 1970. It's 1875, and is this cowboy wearing chaps, or is the hero wearing a suit? And I was always fascinated by the historical time period of the film. So even John Wayne's last film, The Shootist,
mm-hmm.
is so fascinating because it's set. He's reading a paper about the death of Queen Victoria. And you know, okay, we're at the end of the century here, and there are railroad, there are streetcar tracks, and there are electric lines in the street, and so history is an important part of the film, and I think that a lot of historical research has gone into his films, and I think that's true in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, not to the extent that. We're looking at historical figures, but the concern to put things in like that steam tractor.
That's right.
The concern for costume, the concern with the fact, an interest in the fact that the West knew about the fashions of the East, and so you get the fixation of the men. For instance, in the film with the facial hair,
mm-hmm.
Should I cut my sideburns off, or should I trim this beard? That kind of thing, a sensitivity to not just historical events, but to cultural change, the changes in fashion,
mm-hmm.
And I think certainly that one of the things that's most fascinating to me about a film like McCabe and Mrs. Miller is the fact that the historicity of the film lies in the representation of big business, the representation of prostitution, a concern to talk about things that the Western didn't talk about, the traditional Western, but that history was replete with. You know, the West wasn't developed without big business, big railroads and Chinese labor and everywhere little mining towns started, here come prostitutes. So it's that element, that historical element of this film, I think, is one of the really important aspects of it.
I think so, and you talk about culture, and this goes hand in hand with the culture of filmmaking that was emerging from that time. I think something that's very conducive to that train of thought is the notion of the anti-hero, which you can certainly place McCabe in that category, because you have an idea of that kind of figure strolling into a town, and he's got a big dream. But McCabe is very endearing, but he's bumbling. He fumbles a lot. And the strength of Mrs. Miller, the strength of the woman in that society, that was very different to show in that genre movie particularly.
I agree. I think it's telling that he took the novel that was called McCabe and turned it into a film called McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It's also interesting that I think Roger Ebert pointed this out some time ago, that he uses not the and of the title is not A-N-D, but it's the ampersand. It's like a corporation. This is a partnership. And the romance element is really, from a lot of points of view, is a bust. I mean, the hero doesn't get the girl. He doesn't even, he has to pay to have sex with her.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And in many ways, she's the stronger of the two. She's the stronger and the more aggressive and the wittier. And, you know, the film develops this in so many interesting ways. You know, the whole affectation of McCabe of opening a raw egg into a glass of whiskey and drinking it down.
Right.
And he does that, and she comes in and downs this dinner like she's been working on the railroad all day. Eating and drinking without, not at all ladylike, and he just sits there in amazement looking at her. And I think in little ways Altman establishes what is a major element of that film. You talk about the anti-hero. I think that, again, it's one of those moments of irreverence, if you will, that's in Altman. But I love the shot where McCabe is drunk and he's in his offices and he's just finished eating and he's so drunk he can't even close the face of his watch, and he can't put the watch in his watch pocket in his vest. And he's burping and he's farting and he's just I mean, this is not only a cowboy star, this is Warren Beatty.
Right.
Yeah, one of the most kind of beautiful stars of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, you're right. On one hand, it's a part of the era. You know, the counterculture and the resistance attitudes, the anti-establishment attitudes of the end of the 1960s and the early 1970s didn't respect authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the hero in any kind of genre was just another representation of, in this case, narrative authority. And McCabe is, he's as Mrs. Miller says at one point, he's just a small timer who's screwing up her business.
Right.
I think that's one of the, you know, Beatty plays that role really well.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when he's he's completely befuddled.
Mm-hmm.
There are other times when he's just moved by absolute braggadocio. He doesn't have a clue what's going on, of course, with the company, the mining company, and there are other times when he's revealing of himself in ways that he never could imagine Gary Cooper or John Wayne saying, "I've got poetry in me."
No, you could not.
I think that the representation of the hero, and of course, it's not just in the way the movie represents the character of Pudgy McCabe,
mm-hmm.
also not a great nickname for
him. No, not at all.
Western hero. The way he represents the character of McCabe, but also the fact that he has him dead in the snow at the end of the film. I mean, you know, it's not only in his character, but it's in what happens to him,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
his inability to win at the end. And the irony, of course, is that he does end up shooting everybody.
Yeah.
He doesn't do it in the straight on way that the old heroes did. He has to shoot one of them in the back, and he has to shoot the other one with the gambler's gun with the
right.
little Derringer at the end. But he does shoot everybody. He still dies in the snow at the
mm-hmm.
end. And
such a beautiful. I mean, it the movie is unlike any other that I've ever experienced in that. It's all about the emotion of it, and it's just some sort of beautiful sadness, a beautiful melancholy that the film kind of washes over you.
Yes.
I think it's perfect.
Yes.
I mean, what Mr. Self said, it's a poem. And
yeah.
I
think
it is. It really is.
Let me ask you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, well, you know, that mood begins the film, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
really, with the first chords of Leonard Cohen.
Absolutely.
You know, the and the sense I argue that this whole film really is focused in many ways through Mrs. Miller and
mm-hmm.
Mrs. Miller's eyes, and it's almost as though if you know the end of the film and then you look at the film a second time. You realize, you know, those words of Cohen's, you've seen this kind of man before. Who's the you? You know, is this is a kind of colloquy between the woman who's lying in that opium den at the end of the film and her experience. You know, here's just another Joseph looking for a manger. Here's just another guy who's reaching for the sky just to surrender. And the film begins with the kind of melancholy or the sort of tragic sense that it ends on.
Mm-hmm.
It colors the whole, that emotion of the end kind of colors so much of the whole film.
Yeah. I'm wondering your take on this because, as you've written before, Altman's films were admired but very puzzling to audiences and to quite a few critics as well. And McCabe was one that didn't receive the full recognition it deserved upon its release. I'm wondering, what did people begin to understand and appreciate about that film as the years went by that they didn't quite get when it first came out?
Well, we're still trying to get it into the pantheon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we are.
It's not totally recognized yet, and what you guys are doing here is a part of that, I think. Even when I did this book, my editor, a guy named Mike Briggs at the University of Kansas Press, emailed me. He says, "I believe that McCabe and Mrs. Miller is one of the great all-time American films, and we ought to have a book about it." And if you don't want to do it, let me know who could. And certainly that was a part of the motivation of my writing about the film. I don't know. I think the reaction that I've had to the book has been from folks who have said, "Boy, you know, I was really delighted to see your book because I'm totally convinced this is one of the great American films."
Yeah.
And it's almost like what there is there's this underground out there
mm-hmm.
of folks who have appreciated the film for a long time, and then the mainstream of viewers who still are not, I think it's not just this film. I think it's Altman's work in general. I think his films...
Mm-hmm. I think that's his, very true.
Yeah, they just proved to be hard to like. And they were not only hard to follow, but a lot of people just didn't like them. And I haven't understood that emotion forever. but still, I think it's there. And then I think in movies, there's so many things going on. You know, a film like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, John Wayne called it a corrupt film. And there were a lot of people who felt like it was a travesty of the traditional Western. So you get the believers who, and a lot of that happened in the 60s, you know, and it didn't just happen in film, it happened in the other arts as well. And it,
John Wayne also went after Sergio Leone's films and the Eastwood films too. He thought those were travesties as well. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, there were a lot of people, technical people, who were listening to what Altman was doing with sound experiments, and they were just aghast. Because classical Hollywood worked very hard at establishing a clear soundtrack that kept you tied to the story and let you follow from beginning to end what was going on. And so there were reactions, I think, to the sort of sacrilegious approach to one of our almost divine genres, the Western.
Mm-hmm.
There were reactions to the experiments, the visual experiments, because just as it was hard to hear, it was for some people hard to see. What am I supposed to look at here?
Yeah.
What's the, you know, you look at a movie like The Long Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
There are moments in that film when you're watching interplay between the detective character and other characters in the story where the camera is just sort of moving around. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
not, it's moving sideways, it's moving forward, there's just this constant and apparently totally unmotivated movement in the camera, which caused
yeah.
people like Antonioni to love it,
mm-hmm.
but which just totally puzzled American film audiences. What the hell's going on here? So I think that, and then he didn't tell stories that were especially lovable, you know, they're kind of bleak and they don't end happy. And so I think that those attitudes have continued, although it was very interesting when he died how many of the obits said over and over again, you know, his most beautiful movie is McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And
yeah. I love this this Roger Ebert review and his review of
yeah.
great movies. And I think he specifies it at the end here. He says, poor McCabe, he had poetry in him. Too bad he rode into a town where nobody knew what poetry was but one, and she had already lost it.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh.
That's a great line.
Yep, that's great. That's a great quotation. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting scenes in the movie is the scene where it's a very complicated scene, I think. In terms of its visual construction. But it's that moment when McCabe, Mrs. Miller has left her room. It's the night before the showdown. And it's dawn, it's early morning, it's still dark, and he's loading his gun and he's getting dressed. And he does that long soliloquy about how I've got poetry in me and how, you know, you're burning my soul. You know, you don't give me any room. You don't really respect me or love me. And I guess, you know, I'm never was a percentage man. I guess the only kind of woman I'd ever like is a prostitute anyway, or I know is a prostitute. And it's a revealing. It's a revealing moment. He's a sort of liberated man, I guess you could say, in that new light of things. He could talk about these emotions. But one of the things that was striking about, as I was working on this project, I looked at the archive records of the shooting materials from this film that are at the Wisconsin Film and Theater Archive in Madison. And one of the things that's in this archives is a shot record of the whole production process. And in most of the time, Altman would work in like six takes. You know, he'd set up a scene and they'd rehearse it some, and then he'd shoot it five, six times, and he'd be happy and they'd move on. But in this particular scene, he'd done half a dozen shots. It was getting late, and Warren Beatty was never happy with what they'd done. And so Altman said, okay, he said, just let him do it. He said to his assistant director, he said, do as many takes as he wants. I'm going to bed.
Yeah.
And so Beatty did that shot. They did that shot 25 times.
Wow.
They took that shot 25 times. And it's in the record. You can see all of these shots. And Altman, when asked about it, he said, I think I used a third take. but what's telling about it is that Beatty cared a great deal about that moment in the film. The only person in town who still knew he had poetry in him was himself, and that soliloquy, Beatty cared enough about to put that much energy in the process of making the film.
Yeah.
Wonderful moment, and it certainly reflects that quotation from Roger Ebert.
And we've got great stuff in terms of the relationship between Altman and Beatty. We got some great stuff from David Foster.
Yeah.
good.
We're,
yeah.
We're loving
I would
the show.
Love it would have been fun to trail around them watching that.
Process. Oh, it would have been
that shoot. Are you talking about the music much in your?
Were there any thoughts that you?
I think that the music. It's interesting to me. Aficionados of the movie think that these three songs of Leonard Cohen's are absolutely central to the effect of the film. And in Cohen criticism, you find that a lot of people think that these three songs of Cohen's work have become indelibly linked to this movie, so that they don't exist by themselves anymore. The movie and the music are sort of intertwined. And I was, in doing the research on this film, absolutely fascinated by the fact that Altman's story of how the music came to be. And I don't know if you had intended to talk about any of this, but
yes.
You know, he had struggled with the idea of what kind of music are we going to use, and he had given up on the idea, thought about doing a score for it, and you might probably got some of this with Foster too, from him. And they thought about using some period music, which they do indeed anyway, but he was at a party in Paris. After the movie was over, somebody was playing the first Leonard Cohen album.
Yeah.
And Altman said, that's my movie. And he, and I forget who, somebody else in the production process was with him. They immediately left Paris the next morning, flew back to the States to get in touch with Cohen to buy these songs from him. When they were making the movie, that Cold Day in the Park,
mm-hmm.
in Vancouver in 1969, it was right after Cohen's album had come out, and he said that it played constantly in the production office. He said they even wore out one of the albums and had to buy a new one. And he claims that unconsciously, that music was in his head when they were making McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Wow.
The music in that apartment in Paris, he understood that fact.
Yeah.
and went and procured the music. And so that, you know, then you want to look back at the film and look at the ways in which the rhythm of the music is in the camera movement and the editing and everything.
Bob, thank you so much, my
friend.
Thank
you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Robert Self. His book is called McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Reframing the American West. It is a must-read, and just as this is a must-see film. Great guy. I could have talked to him forever.
Oh, he was just positively charming. Just really a great guy.
speaking of great guys and great
authority, a very great guy
on this film, we're really excited. We're running a little bit behind, and we apologize to him. He's been waiting so patiently for us. Our final guest of the evening, Doug Pratt, is one of the most prolific and respected film critics on the scene today. He's the editor and publisher of the DVD Laserdisc newsletter, which enjoys a worldwide circulation and has been quoted by the likes of Time, Newsweek, and the New York Times. He's authored several books on the medium, including a massive and valuable two-volume publication titled Doug Pratt's DVD, Movies, Television, Music, Art, Adult, and More. It's a great, great privilege to welcome to the show Mr. Doug Pratt. Let's see, bring up his line. Doug, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You've been so patient with us. I appreciate it.
Well, I've been enjoying the show.
Thank you.
If I understand correctly, you've seen tens of thousands of movies.
Yeah, well, I mean, I keep a database of my reviews. So I have, you know, reviewed more than 22,000 films.
Wow.
22,000 titles. And, you know, so probably in my life I've seen more than 30,000 movies. And of all the films I've seen, McCabe and Mrs. Miller is my favorite movie. Now, you know, everybody's favorite movie comes from when, you know, during the formative years of their lives. I'm sure that's part of it. You know, I was an adolescent when the film came out and that sort of thing. But, it struck me right away. I really loved it. And within like 2 or 3 years, it had become my favorite, and it's been my favorite ever since then.
Well, you mentioned that you saw it in your formative years, and I think it's true for a lot of us, and it's certainly true for great films that stand the test of time. You benefit from repeat performances over the years. You get more out of it, and I find that with McCabe, that there's always something else to discover in the film. I'm wondering, what kind of discoveries have you made as the years have gone by?
Well, okay, I think what strikes me most about it is how much it is about America. And the real America, you know, I mean, I love the movies of John Ford, don't get me wrong, but, you know, Monument Valley is like this abstract, symbolic version of America. I mean, you can't actually grow anything there. You can't live there. I mean, that's why he was able to make so many movies there, because there wasn't anybody there.
Right.
But this on the other, you know, the setting in McCabe and Mrs. Miller is like every back lot today. I'm not back, you know, not a movie back lot, but, you know, the lot behind your own house that's overgrown, that's being cleared out so that somebody can put a house there. I mean, you can still, you know, you can draw a straight line from what's happening in your own backyard through McCabe and Mrs. Miller to how America grew up, you know,
right.
How America began, you know, especially in the West. But then, you know, from that you can extrapolate that this was probably how the East Coast, you know, was formed, 200, 300 years earlier, you know. So there's just this line that is so clear that's, you know, you can step out in your own backyard, you can, you know, put your hand in the dirt that's in your garden, and you can feel, you know, how America was formed, you know, with this movie as your reference point. Because, and the other beautiful thing about the movie is, you know, the production design, it literally, they are building the set as they are, you know, as the movie is advancing, you know, so that it grows in front of your eyes, and you see, like, you know, the beginning of America and how America got started right before your eyes. And that really struck me as, like, its central core. But, of course, it's just, like, so beautiful. And yeah, I think one of the things that wasn't really mentioned as much as a lot of the other things in the previous speakers is how funny it is, you know, how much, you know, humor there is in it. And I think between the humor and the beauty of it, and of course the beauty in the music, the beauty in the cinematography, and just the fact that, you know, almost every single scene is so cozy, you know, it's kind of sends you back to, like, you feel like you're in like a little, you know, a shack, but you're warm, and outside it's cold, and you're sitting there with people, and it just, it conveys that emotion of coziness to you. And all of that, and I think that's why, you know, you can have the hero dying in the snow by himself at the end, and, you know, you're not too bummed out about it. You know, it kind of like becomes this, you know, a profound move rather than a choice that, like, you know, destroys the film for you or anything like that, because there just has been so much humor and so much beauty and so much atmosphere preceding it that you can, you know, accommodate a downer ending and accept it and you know, feel enlightened by it.
Yeah. I'm wondering your take on this. Obviously, it's a window into the past, the film itself, but in terms of the time it was made, 1971, a great time in movies. How was it informed by the culture of that time, do you think? That made
well,
it?
Clearly everyone's hair is long.
Right.
and I think also the opium, you know, I mean, it's drawing a line there. Yes, there was opium in our past, but we had, you know, collectively, you know, forgotten about it until this point. In fact, to think back, I don't know, you know, what Westerns, you know, before this had dealt with, you know, with opium smoking, with drugs or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think there was that many. So it certainly was embracing, you know, attitudes and the culture of the 60s and that sort of thing. And I think the other thing again is the humor was, you know, fairly raw, and you know, the language was unabashed. And at that point in time, that was still a rarity. I mean, it wasn't completely unknown, but it was a rarity to have that frank, the frankness of the humor and the earthiness of the humor really hadn't been done too much before. So that was another, you know, piece of the times. And the other thing is, you know, around the 70s, there was also this, you know, big return to, you know, living off the land and, you know, hippies living in the woods and that sort of thing, which, you know, was again kind of a reference to where we had come from. And, you know, and at that point in time, I mean, there were certainly people alive who had been alive at the time that the film was made. So there was this, you know, you always kind of like skip a generation or two, and I think young people were kind of looking back not at their parents' generation but at their grandparents and their great-grandparents and trying to search for some of those values. You know, I mean, there are certainly some values that they weren't interested in searching for, but there were some that they were, and the living naturally, living off the land, getting away from actually getting away from the kind of world that McCabe wants to create in one sense. I mean, you know, you're kind of like looking back at the perspective and saying, okay, this is where we want to get back to, but then these guys here, they wanted to get forward to where we are. So there's, you know, a kind of a circular path there that you know, is informed by the film, and I'm sure that the filmmakers were cognizant of it as they were making it.
Yeah. Yeah, I often read it referred to as an anti-Western, sometimes as a hippie Western.
Well, or a Pacific Northwestern.
That's true.
Exactly. We haven't discussed much in previous interviews the performances in the film, and you have two major performances, a very interesting time in both of their careers, both personally and professionally, Warren Beatty and Julie Christie. Can you shed some light on
that? Okay, yeah, well, I mean, I think even more so than that, I mean, one of the things you see is the ensemble performance of everybody,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the way that Altman and his sound designers are miking everybody and capturing everybody, they always have to be, you know, on target and stuff. And, you know, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing his last name, but René Auberjonois. Yeah, he kind of stands out right away as, you know, like really he's really the first person that you meet and get a handle on even before, you know, I realize that Warren Beatty's character is the first character you see, but it's his character is the first character that you really understand and relate to, and then it's through his eyes that you start to see, you know, the other characters come out. And so yeah, the performances down the line are you know, really wonderful. One of the things I was noticing, you know, the most recent time I watched the film was, you know, there's like a some of the things that Warren Beatty is doing, you can see him also doing in Bonnie and Clyde, that he took, you know, some mannerisms and some tricks and carried them over, even some you know, I think even some phrases, though they don't come to my head right away, but you know, there's little things that he's doing that he carries straight over from that. And it's also, yeah, you know, on the other hand, I'm wondering if the film didn't in some way hurt his career in that, you know, he does this fumbling and mumbling and that stuff so well. He got such a handle on it, which is really what his innovation is on this, you know, is that this, you know, is the total fumbling, total just kind of fuzzy-headed responses to the world around him, that he carried that mannerism over into some of his later films, and people had trouble responding to it because it wasn't, you know, the clear-spoken heroism that he had had in some of his earlier performances. Julie Christie, I think, is more like the classic British school performance, where she's, you know, placed in a part and she delivers the part, but she delivers it exquisitely.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, in her line readings, it's in how she's looking and how she's standing and how she's breathing, and, you know, every scene that she's in, you do kind of gravitate towards watching her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe because she's, you know, the only, like, you know, kind of like, you know, classy woman or British woman or what have you in the film, that you do kind of gravitate towards her in that respect. But, you know, she certainly delivers what is expected of her, you know, superbly and flawlessly. So, you know, I mean, and to another extent, yeah, the film probably wouldn't work if Warren Beatty and Julie Christie were not the icons that they are.
Right.
I mean, that's another way that it stands out, that it can play against the, you know, the overlapping dialogue and the fuzzy, messy way that the scenes advance and that sort of thing, because you have two such strong movie stars sitting in these central roles that, you know, because the material that they're given is good enough to carry the story along and to be interesting and that sort of thing, that they just have to, like, be there, and it's a tent pole, you know, it's a tent pole, it's not the tent pole, but it's one of the tent poles for the film. It's just that you have these two icons playing against each other, and that's another thing that helps hold the film together.
Yeah. Do you have a it's such a perfect film, it would be hard to isolate one part of it, but is there a moment in the film that ranks amongst your personal delights more than any other?
I really, you know, it's really more of the atmosphere as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and the music accompanying it. So, you know, it's just like the opening shot of Warren Beatty on the horse, you know, going through what is clearly not so much the West as it is, you know, it's not the West that we don't know. It's the West that we do know. It's the back lot, the backyard, the wilderness that we're still familiar with today, and Leonard Cohen's music playing over it. I think just that opening shot of him, you know, it just is rapturous. And from there, you just are carried along through the rest of the film. So, you know, maybe that, I think maybe my one other favorite moment is at the other end where he's dead in the snow. And he's just sitting there in the middle of the snowbank, and you know, everything that happens in between is so enchanting that you know, you can't really pull out one shot or one moment that is set apart from the others. I know one thing that you were talking about before was the cinematography and how grainy and that sort of thing it is, and iffy it is. Don't think that the snowstorm at the end would have worked so well if the cinematography had been clean and bright and shiny in the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it has to be kind of, overly grainy, overly saturated and that sort of thing to match what happens at the end. And you can't really have the end unless you have the snow coming down, and you can't really see the snow coming down unless it looks a little bit like rain and stuff. And so in that sense, I think the rest of the movie has to kind of accommodate it. I don't know if that was their plan or not, but that's how it works for me, is that, the film has had a particularly difficult time on home video, because for a long time it just, you know, it was so grainy that the additional grain that was brought by poor home video transfers and stuff was very frustrating. I think the DVD release rectified that a little bit, and it's certainly a lot more stable now, so that you can appreciate the grain without being turned off by it. And then, like I say, when the snowstorm then appears at the end, it fits right in. It doesn't, you know, it isn't jarring or something that, you know, like, stands out as phony or anything like that, because it fits with the visual tone of the rest of the film.
Well, I do think it's one of the most amazing visual experiences.
Yeah, I mean, it does indeed remind one of French Impressionism. know, I mean, you really do get kind of that
right.
pointillism or haziness that you, but yet you see everything clearly in another, you know, on another plane. It's all very, very clear. And,
yeah.
and like I say, it's clear emotionally, even if it isn't clear in specific detail.
Whenever I think of the film, the first images that pop in my head are from that closing gun battle. And first of all, when I first saw it, I was thinking, Robert Altman has a gunfight.
yeah, it's well done too. I mean, it's suspenseful and it really works really well. Yeah,
but it also very uniquely Altman in that, if I remember correctly, when McCabe is shot. It occurs from over the shooter's shoulder. It occurs at a distance when you see him fall. So it's not set up like your typical Western, where close up on the hero being shot and
well,
death.
Yeah, I don't know about that though, because then he has the comeback with the Derringer. So that
okay.
you know, yeah. So that is kind of a classic thing. But I think the fact that previous to that, he shoots both of the other men in the back. You know, and then he himself gets shot in the back as well. You know, everybody's shooting everybody else in the back, kind of thing. But
no music, just the kind of the sounds of the snow. And my understanding was that the snow wasn't planned. There was a snowstorm, and Beatty wanted to postpone it. And Altman said, "No, we're going with it. It's happening."
Oh yeah. But you can also watch. You know, I mean, the snow does. Come down, you know, if you like watch the ending, in the first few shots there's just a little, you know, sprinkling of snow on the ground, and then by the end there's about, you know, a foot and a half to 2 feet. So it comes down, you know, unusually hard for that situation,
right?
But yeah, in fact, the first, before you even hear the Leonard Cohen song, of course, what you hear is the wind. You know, that's like the first sound that you hear coming out of your speakers is the wind.
Speaking of Leonard Cohen, obviously his music just works so beautifully in this film. What makes it so adaptable to this particular material?
I really believe, okay, Altman shared that anecdote about it being on his subconscious on the DVD commentary track, and I totally believe it. I mean, that's the only explanation for it, because the songs do fit the film so well that the film had to be in a certain sense composed with the songs somewhere, you know, in mind. You know, that they just fit so well that you know, the two are indelibly linked, and you can't, you know, you can't hear any one of those three songs without thinking about images from the film. And you know, I apologize to Leonard Cohen fans, but you know, that's the way it is. It's wonderful. You know, I think that it actually has, I think, probably made the songs more enduring than they would have been otherwise. I mean, I certainly prefer, you know, these three songs to, say, Suzanne or So Long, Marianne or a couple of the other numbers on that album. So,
right.
you know, these are the songs that I could listen to a million times and never, ever get tired of. And it's because every time I hear them, I'm transported to the cozy images of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and it just,
it elevates,
you know,
them. In terms of the DVD release that we have now, I believe it features commentary from Altman and David Foster, if I'm not mistaken. Do you think it could benefit from another restoration?
Well, I would be interested to see what they could do with it on Blu-ray, which would, you know, increase the accuracy of the image transfer even more. I imagine, though, that it would be a very expensive proposition to remaster it again. So, you know, if they do ever do something, I hope they get this radio show on as one of their extras. I think that would be fantastic.
Oh, thank you. That is just incredible. Thank you.
We love you for that, man.
You get brownie points right there for that.
Your work is fantastic, Doug, and we appreciate you sharing your thoughts on the film. And please come back. I promise you'll have a full hour to discuss whatever topic.
Yeah, really.
I made a list that I have published on my website of my 400 favorite movies, so you can pick out any one of those, and I'll be happy to, like, you know, talk enthusiastically about them and what they mean to me. So
and that's DVDlaser.com.
Uh-huh.
We'll put that up in the chat room,
DVDlaser.com.
You'll read all of Doug Pratt's amazing work on that. And I appreciate your time so much, Doug, and sharing your passion for this film with us, too.
Well, thank you. I hope the word gets out and more people learn about it, because, like you say, it's long overdue to be recognized as one of the great American films.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Doug.
Bye-bye now. All right, that's Movie Geeks United. We're bringing it in under 2 hours.
Awesome show.
Awesome show. Awesome people. Thank you so much to everyone. You can hear the uncut versions of David Foster's interview and Corey Fisher's interview. We talk about a lot of extra things in those interviews. Tell your friends. Go out and pick up a copy of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. This
and their children and all their relatives.
Yeah, exactly. And we will announce the next film we'll be paying tribute to from the decade of the 70s. In the near future.
In the near future, there you go.
Yeah, as for now, we're going to close the show with the signature song from McCabe and Mrs. Miller. This is a great one. Leonard Cohen, The Stranger Song. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender. Who is reaching for the sky just to surrender. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And then leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I came I was a stranger. But now another stranger seems to want you to ignore his dreams as though they were the burden of some other. Oh, you've seen that man before, his golden arm dispatching cards, but now it's rusted from the elbow to the finger. And he wants to trade the game he plays for shelter. Yes, he wants to trade the game he knows for shelter. Oh, you hate to watch another tired man lay down his hand like he was giving up the holy game of poker. And while he talks his dreams to sleep, you notice there's a highway that is curling up like smoke above his shoulder. It's curling just like smoke above his shoulder. You tell him to come in, sit down, but something makes you turn around. The door is open, you can't close your shelter. You try the handle of the road, it opens. Do not be afraid, it's you, my love, you who are the stranger. It is you, my love, you who are the stranger. Well, I've been waiting, I was sure we'd meet between the trains we're waiting for. I think it's time to board another. Please understand, I never had a secret chart to get me to the heart of this or any other matter. Well, he talks like this, you don't know what he's after. When he speaks like this, you don't know what he's after. Let's meet tomorrow if you choose upon the shore beneath the bridge that they are building on some endless river. And he leaves the platform for the sleeping car that's warm. You realize he's only advertising one more shelter. And it comes to you, he never was a stranger. And you say, okay, the bridge or someplace later. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I